Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning. Welcome Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600.
Good morning, Congressman Himes. I know there were a lot of big things that came out of the address from President Biden to Congress a couple days ago. I wanted to talk about one thing that I think is going to be a big deal for Connecticut specifically. The president had mentioned expanding the child tax credit. Could you talk a little bit about this and how it connects to Connecticut families?
Yeah, sure. Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, that's a good one. You know, a lot of things in the president's proposal. We can talk more about that later. But the child tax credit has been proven over time to be a hugely successful way of lifting kids out of poverty. And I think, you know, regardless of where we are politically, making sure kids don't grow up in poverty is a really important thing, because kids that grow up in poverty, of course, are not kids who succeed in school, who ultimately become economically successful, et cetera. I'm generalizing, of course, but that's in generally true. So the child tax credit provides, in this case, up to about $3,000 to families with children who are below certain income levels. As part of the American Rescue Plan passed in early January, I guess it was, or late January, we did temporarily increase the funds available for the child tax credit. But the president is, of course, choosing to make that. Or suggesting we make that permanent.
Now, I also know, Congressman Himes, you have kind of a hand in knowing what's going on internationally. And we've talked a little bit about, like, the bringing our forces home, our troops home, thing like that. I think it's interesting that the president, you know, made it a very clear statement that he's like, look, we're pulling our troops. But I know past administrations have said the same thing. So I know families here who have either young men or young women in their families who are still serving overseas. What is the likelihood of seeing our troops actually be pulled? Like, how are we going to do that?
It's going to happen. It's going to happen. And remember, people sometimes forget that we've only got, we're down to something like 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. So this is not the world of, 10 years ago when we had, 70,000, 100,000 troops there. We have a very, very small number of troops in Afghanistan. And I very much support the president in this. I mean, as he pointed out in his speech the other night, 20 years, our longest war, kids who weren't born when the war started are serving there. And it's enormously expensive, both in terms of lives and our taxpayer dollars. And the truth is, Melissa, I mean, this isn't a happy thing to say, but, I could list for you a dozen countries where we need to be as aggressive in counterterrorism as we do in Afghanistan, places like Syria and Somalia and Libya. All of those places have the kind of ungoverned spaces where if al-Qaeda wanted to, they could reconstitute. So having a disproportionately heavy military footprint in Afghanistan in some ways detracts from the work that we need to do in a lot of other unstable countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, Congressman Himes, another thing I just want to kind of dive in and dip into all these different things with you. I know we have limited time. President Biden also is obviously talking about more child care plans, making it more affordable for families, which I am 110% on board with. But I also know he has talked about trying to make college free in some regards. And I want to talk a little bit about this because obviously someone is going to have to pay for it. You know, like nothing is ever free. So even though it is kind of taking the burden off of college students, we do need to talk about the other side of it. Who would be paying for this free college?
Well, the president has proposed, you heard him in his speech, the president has proposed that the programs, and by the way, let me tell you, I support most of what the president has proposed. I think in some instances his proposals are too big,
mm-hmm.
And part of the reason is because we're going to need a lot of tax revenue to pay for them.
Right.
You heard the president say that he would raise income taxes and capital gain taxes on households making more than $400,000 a year. He pledged not to raise any taxes on people making less than that, and that's, of course, the vast majority of Americans. But I think, in the next couple of weeks in the Congress, at the end of the day, it's going to be the Congress that makes these decisions.
Right.
We're going to have a negotiation about which of the programs are the worthiest. And I really do think education is one of them. And let me tell you why, because it comes right back to the question you asked, which is there's no getting around the fact that some of the programs that the president has proposed are expensive. But let's think about education for a second. Let's think about a kid who doesn't graduate high school. That kid is going to be lucky to be in a minimum wage world, right? Making whatever, $35,000, $40,000 a year. If you can get that kid to finish college or to go on to more advanced training in HVAC or electricity or whatnot, now all of a sudden they're making a whole bunch more money. And by the way, that's just a fact, right? There's lots of studies that show that that income correlates with level of education. They're making a whole lot more money, which is great for them and great for their community, and, of course, results in higher levels of revenue for the government.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, though, Congressman, while I do totally agree, I think that sometimes when you look at the costs of college, it turns people away, right? I mean, people sometimes will go, listen, we just can't afford it. So I get that. However, I'm wondering why it has inflated so much. Like, if you even look at, for example, I'm just throwing an example out there, but like my college in Vermont, private 2,000 person school college, whatever, that has already gone up, no joke, $25,000 since I graduated, a yep. year, might I add, since I graduated only 9-10 years ago. So really not, I mean, that's a lot. And I look at the fact that I go, oh, please, dear God, don't let my son want to go to our alma mater, which is sad, but I'm like, please don't go there. But then I look at his options and I think to myself, well, this is crazy. It is expensive. So I agree with you there. I'm just wondering, why has it inflated so much? Like, I'm wondering why it even has gotten to the point where it's just not even affordable for people to want to send their kids to school.
Yeah. Oh, you made me feel old. Graduated 9 or 10 years ago. I'll tell you, I feel your pain. I'm paying for two kids in college right now, and I am paying almost four times what I paid when I graduated.
Wow.
Not 9 or 10 years ago. But anyway, two things need to happen here. I think, well, lots of things need to happen, but two, because we have limited time. Number one, universities have got to stop raising their tuition 8 or 9% every single year.
You right,
know, two
it's
and
insane.
Three times the cost of inflation. And there's a bunch of reasons that they do that, right? You know, they feel they need to compete. So now we need gyms that look like, you know, high-end luxury gyms. And, and the hard part is, of course, the government doesn't get to tell a private university what they can
and can't do, right?
But we do get to tell them that if you do, you know, that we're not going to help finance the unbelievable debts that kids carry to go to these colleges. The other thing that needs to happen is, you know, societally, Melissa, we need to, and you know what, let me raise my hand and own up to being part of the problem here, because like you, I was a four-year college guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we gotta rethink whether 4 years, you know, at a brick building with ivy on it or whatever is really the right model. For some kids, it's going to be 2 years. I mentioned HVAC, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned, you know, the trades. There's, you know, maybe things like computer programming. Not every career is going to require a four-year education.
Mm-hmm.
We got to be innovative about those models, and we need to stop this prejudice towards a four-year college education. Remember, only 40% of Americans go on to higher education, right? So we're already leaving. If we're making an obsession out of a four-year university, we're already sort of not talking to most Americans. So I do think there needs to be a lot of innovation and change, because there's plenty of ways to get training, to get the skills that'll make you a very solid middle-class American without necessarily going to a four-year college.
We're kind of diving into the plans of maybe getting free college. So I have a couple more questions for you, Congressman Himes. First of all, something that you had mentioned actually before the break, you had said that if you're a high school graduate and you're able to get maybe that two or even four-year college experience under your belt, it's going to mean you make more money. The only thing I'm going to say is, like, I even know in my own career, thank God my parents had the money to pay for all of my college and I don't have loans, because otherwise I don't make money where it would pay for paying back my college tuition is the best way I could put it. Like, I think what's interesting is, you know, we talk about the value of a four-year college, and yet I know so many friends of mine who work in either they work in social work, they work in media, they work in many other lines, and unless it's like business or healthcare, they're struggling to pay back their loans. They can't even move out of their parents' home. So I wonder if you could touch on that as well, like if the value of really going to a four-year college is even really there when you see that we're not getting the jobs that can actually pay our loans back, let alone our bills, to stand on our own two feet.
Yeah, that's right, Melissa. And it takes us right back to what we were just talking about, which is at some point, universities have got to be you know, their costs have to reflect the ability of people to purchase them, right? And so, you know, just this week, actually, I spent an hour on the phone with a group of young people who had gotten together to highlight the student loan crisis, right? Because it's lending that makes this possible. The only reason universities can raise their costs, because, you know, almost nobody can afford to pay, you know, cash on the barrel to go to these colleges. The only way kids can go to these colleges is to take on enormous debt. So now what happens? Now, you know, you get some kid graduating a four-year university with $100,000 in debt, and that kid is not buying a home. That kid's not buying a house. It has a real economic effect, apart from the, you know, the anxiety that people carry. So, you know, the way we fix this, there's a lot of proposals out there to reduce the amount of student debt out there. And you know what? I'm open to talking about that, to how we might do that, because I do think there are people who are being asked to carry debt that they can't possibly ever repay. But you got to get at the underlying problem, which is that, I mean, you look at these expensive colleges, they will tell you 95% of the kids there have some form of financial aid, loans or grants or what have you.
Right. What does that tell you?
Sustainable.
Yeah.
That's just not sustainable.
No, it's not. And I know that the job market, it's like, oh, 99% of our students get a job. That's great. But it doesn't mean it's paying off those student loans. That's not what it's saying. So I want to just kind of end by going back to my initial question. The idea of free college, who's paying for it?
Right. Well, remember, though, the proposal here is that Americans would qualify for two years of community college, right? So we're not talking about $80,000 a Yale, Yale University here. So, you know, there are some things we need to work out there, because, look, the idea of saying we've said we should have public schools that take you through to the age 18, it's not crazy to say that there ought to be another 2 years tacked on to that if you want it, right? People of means wouldn't necessarily have to take advantage of those 2 years, and many people wouldn't. But the idea is that, you know, we shouldn't prevent somebody from getting post-secondary education for 2 years because they can't afford it. So, yeah, you know, I actually think that's a pretty good idea. How it happens is a different discussion, right? One of the problems we have out there is that some states have actually pretty expensive community colleges. You know, tuition will be is not expensive by private standards, but tuition is $10,000 a year or something, whereas some states have much less expensive. So there's an argument that what you really do is you expand the kind of grants that are available to kids to go to schools rather than just simply paying the tuition. But we'll work that out. I mean, that'll be the subject of our conversations in the coming months in the Congress.
Okay, so you would go more grant versus, to me, it sounds like this would fall on a taxpayer.
Well, either way, it falls on the taxpayer. I mean, let's be real about this, right? Any money that the government spends, whether it's on a Pell Grant for a student or for an F-35 jet fighter or for Social Security or Medicare, every dollar we spend either gets paid for by a taxpayer dollar or it gets added to our debt. People tend to forget that, right? You know, especially after a time where we've spent trillions of dollars to pull ourselves out of this COVID nightmare. But at the end of the day, every dollar we spent eventually either gets added to our debt or gets paid for by taxpayers. And that's why we've got an obligation to think really hard about these programs.
Congressman Jim Himes, I wish we had more time. I want to keep talking about this, but I know we have run out. Thank you so much for the extra time this morning. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
What's happening in Hartford and how it affects you? Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly joins Melissa in the morning now on WICC 600.
All right, so Senator Kelly, I saw that you have started a new grassroots effort. It's called Stop the Gas Tax CT. I'm not really surprised by this. You and I have talked about this a lot on the show, just so that folks can kind of catch up if they missed it. What is this all about? What are you trying to bring to people's attention?
Well, Melissa, nobody should be surprised, because I think if you walk in the shoes of middle-class families in Connecticut, you realize the tax burden that we all face. And what we're trying to do is we started a grassroots campaign. We kicked it off earlier this week. We did it on Wednesday. We had a rally yesterday on Lordship Boulevard in Stratford. Got overwhelming support. And what we're trying to do is just raise the level of awareness to bring out to the communities across our state that the Democrats in Hartford are increasing taxes when they're telling people they're not. And I think when people start to realize just how much and how expensive these taxes are going to be, and the governor says, oh, this is just going to – we're using the gas tax as an example – this is just a small tax. It's only a nickel on a gallon of gas. Well, that's not being candid and honest with the people of Connecticut. First and foremost, he wants $100 million of revenue. And if he wants it in the name of an environmental initiative, and Tufts University said in order to accomplish the goal he is promising, you're going to need more like 38 cents a gallon. And that's a big difference. And
yes,
people need to know what the policies are and what's actually going on. And we started the campaign, and if they want more information and to sign our petition, they can go to stopthegastaxct.com. Learn more about this issue, find out what the governor and the Democrats are doing, and then decide for yourself whether you think paying more at the gas pump is worth it or not.
So I guess, Senator Kelly, my question would be, you know, because obviously you're hearing both sides of the argument and it can get confusing. For example, last week when you brought this up on our show and you talked about how much money this is actually going to cost Connecticut taxpayers and really proving that it is hitting middle class wallets, I literally verbatim said exactly your fact to Governor Lamont. And he said, that's just not true. So, like, what do you say to that?
Well, that's why I'm saying go to stopthegastaxct.com to learn more about the issue, because I'm laying the facts out. I'm not just telling people what I'm trying to coax them into. I'm showing them the facts. And the fact is that the governor has called this a tax. The governor has said he wants $100 million. And Tufts University is saying that what he is proposing here, the gas tax for a climate initiative, won't work. Those aren't my words. I'm not the one saying this. These are the governor's words. These are Tufts University's words. And by the way, the Sierra Club has withdrawn its support of this initiative because it's not going to accomplish the goals. These are the facts. Now, the governor's and the Democrats don't like those facts, because basically what they're doing is asking the middle class to pay more at a time when we are getting historic dollars out of Washington, billions of dollars more than we ever knew we were going to get. The current budget is in a surplus.
Right.
And that's not enough for the Democrats. They want more. And what this is just a money grab.
Well, and we've seen this before.
For what it is.
Yeah. No, and we've seen this before, Senator Kelly. We've definitely seen middle class Connecticut residents take on taxes before from similar pushes. Now, what, Senator Kelly, I have to imagine, I was watching this morning one of our local news sources, because I know you were out with other residents in Stratford at a local gas station pushing this and trying to get support as well. I saw on one of the local news stations that Senator Bob Duff immediately responded, and he said, I think the quote was, and if I'm not exactly right, my apologies, but it was something along the lines to the effect of typical Republican move using a scare tactic. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there you go. The fact of the matter is, like I just said, Melissa, I'm bringing the truth to the taxpayers of the state of Connecticut. And if the Democrats think it's scary, it's because their tax policies that affect the middle and low income families of our state is a scary proposition to them. They're the ones that are living hand to mouth on a shoestring budget, trying to make ends meet in our unaffordable state because of the bad policies that the Democrats continue to foist on our families. And, you know, this is the problem. Now, we were very fortunate yesterday to also be joined by Patrick Sasser from No Toll CT. And, you know, we're gaining more and more support. We were over there on Lordship Boulevard. One of the local businesses came over that is trucking, because there's also a mileage tax they're putting out, which is another $100 million tax, which is going to increase the cost of our food at grocery stores. And they came over and told me it's going to increase their bottom line. This tax is going to increase it by $40,000, and they're going to push that on to the consumers. This is what's making Connecticut unaffordable. Exact policies just like this. And when we get out there, you should have heard the horns from the cars and the trucks of people supporting it. And the reason you're getting such pushback from the Democrats is because they know we're hitting the mark. They know that this issue is not good for families, and they're trying to confuse the issue. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm here to tell you that this is an issue that's going to resonate, and we're going to continue to talk about it because middle class and low income families need to know what their government is doing to their family budget.
So if you want to learn more about this, Senator Kelly has outlined the initiative Stop the Gas Tax CT. And if you want to learn more about it and if you would like to sign the petition, go to stopthegastaxct.com. It's all spelled out, just Connecticut is CT at the end of it. Stopthegastaxct.com. Senator Kelly, thank you for your efforts and thank you for explaining it to us this morning on the air. We'll talk again next week.
You bet. Thank you, Melissa.
All right. We'll talk soon. And right now we are checking in with our early education consultant, Liz Englander. Now, Liz, we were talking a little bit earlier this week about how to properly praise our children. I have to imagine there's a good and a bad way, correct?
There certainly is, Melissa. We want to always give them praise when they do something good, but sometimes we could really continually overpraise them. So when it comes to raising confident children, less praise may be more when it comes to building kids' self-esteem. It's very important to find right balance in praising kids between too little and too much.
Mm-hmm.
Overpraising children, if it's not related to a specific accomplishment, does them a disservice. Praise today is literally given routinely, giving kids trophies and turning really them into praise junkies.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah,
it's
true. You know, there's always a gift, there's always something, and they're pretty smart because they look for this,
right?
You know, by doing a good deed or something else. By giving kids heaping portions of praise, parents may think they're building confidence and a sense of self when it may have the opposite effect.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Liz. Just to give an example, we are, yes, as you know, we're going through potty training with Chase. And
yes,
he's only been doing it for 3 weeks, but he's got the number ones down. Like, he's got it. He knows what to do.
Yep.
And I've noticed, it's funny, but like, he'll go to, you know, he'll go to the bathroom and he'll do his stuff. And then he'll come over and he'll go, I did it. And we're like, that's great, bud. And he's looking for us to freak out. And I'm like, but you've got it. Like, I'm not going to sit here and go over the top when you know what you're doing, because I think it gives them false hope. Like, if I even sneeze, you're going to tell me that I'm the best child in the world, when it's like, listen, you should know how to cover your mouth when you sneeze. You know what I'm saying?
You're absolutely right. Sometimes we all overdo this, so
mm-hmm.
we have to take it in moderation. And like, you know, by giving kids heaping portions of praise, parents may think, you know, as I said, they're helping build self-confidence and a sense of self, but it really has an opposite effect. Now, this is very important. Praising kids is an important part of building their self-esteem and confidence as parents and for other adult role models. We have to be careful not to overpraise our kids. It can backfire. Your child may constantly seek approval, just like you're saying, for things which in turn lower self-esteem and cause anxiety to try new things. Now, parents should focus on praise, on specific actions or behaviors instead of blanket statements. If you stick to specific examples instead of generalities, kids will understand the praise and not try to compare themselves with others. And parents should be close in time to the behavior you are praising. Don't overdo it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes
mm-hmm.
a smile and a pat on the back with a simple statement, "You did that very well," is sufficient.
Yeah,
but other times, it's giving them a gift, it's going to the store, it's buying them a toy continually. And they're smarter than we are.
Yeah.
They know by doing this, or grandma, yes, grandpa, they're going to get mm-hmm. something for it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
my little Chase there, he's got a whole team there that I'm sure support him immensely, believe me.
Yes, but he certainly doesn't need a toy for, like I said, sneezing the right way.
No.
Now, Liz Englander,
no,
our early education consultant, what about the opposite effect? What about the parents who have maybe like a militant background almost? And I don't want to say it's just them. I just know from my own experience with marrying a husband who was raised by a military member. You know, my husband grew up where you were never really praised. It was something that showed weakness, actually. It was almost expected of you, even at a young age. And while my in-laws are very nice people, this was the way that they kind of did things. But I do think the opposite effect, not really showing your kids any praise, it certainly did knock my husband for quite some time, that he really had to work on that in his adult life.
Well, it's very difficult because, you know, in my administrative work and as my consulting now, you always see that, and you always see a troubled child in the classroom. And I always used to try to reinforce the positive. There were many children like this. There were many families that didn't know how to praise. They didn't want to praise. They were like sergeants in the army. Mm. And I think you have to build their self-esteem and confidence. You have to give them approval when they do a good task. You have to give them approval, like if they're helping you in the classroom or at home. And, you know, gee, you did a great job today. I'm really proud of you. And if you continually do this, and reinforcement with positive things, because they have to build up their self-esteem. They have never had this. They don't know how to accept it. My husband, too, came from a very nice background, but his dad was very similar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were things that I noticed when we first started to date many years ago, and we worked them out, but it was definitely evident. And, you know, we discuss it still constantly. And when I see it in the schools, I really try to help the teachers and the administrators reinforce it, because it does do damage until they're able to build this up, you know, within themselves. Mm-hmm. And when they go on and get married, as you said, you saw exactly what transpired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we experience it just like you guys. We still talk about it today. Now, Liz, I think this is a tricky one. I think that you could fall somewhere in the middle is obviously the sweet spot, but you could fall on either end of the spectrum. And I'm sure people would love to be able to share with you what they're experiencing or some of the questions that they have. Is there a way people can reach out to you directly and ask you to maybe get involved or give them advice on how to properly praise their kids or grandchildren?
They just need to pick up the phone and call me. I'm always available, Melissa. 203-929-1352, 203-258-4351. I'd love to help them. You know, they don't have to be embarrassed, ashamed. They don't even have to give me their name. If I could be a resource to them, I'll be more than happy to, because these things should be solved before the children, you know, get older. We want to turn our children into happy children and a well-adjusted, responsible, confident adults who are, you know, kind and work well with others. We want them to have a healthy amount of praise when deserved, can get a long way towards their goal. And I think if we all work together in team effort with the schools, with the parents, with whomever, even if they need some professional guidance or help, there's nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. We want to solve these issues before they continue to get out of bounds.
I agree with you. Liz Englander, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Love you. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too.